Sloppy Spoilers with your host, DT2. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sloppy Spoilers. I'm your host, David Taylor II. You know me as DT2 Comics Chat on Twitter. That's where you can find me. That's my handle, at DT2 Comics Chat. In this episode of Sloppy Spoilers, we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 3 of Umbrella Academy. And we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 3 of The Boys. I'd like to welcome my co-host. I'd like to welcome David Nemesis Howard. And how can we find you on Twitter?
Hey, what's going on, everyone? You can find me at NemesisFC2. And great to be here and looking forward to talking about both of these TV shows.
Welcome to Steve Shadewing Sellers. How are you doing, Steve? And where can we find you on Twitter?
Well, doing great. And as far as where to find me, it's the same place I always am. I'm at Shadewing on Twitter, exactly the way that it sounds. And I'm looking forward to talking about these shows, even though I think like one kind of started good and ended bad, and the other one started bad and ended good. So, you know, funny how it works out.
Can't wait to dive in. And welcome to Jeff, Dr. Fate Bracey. How are you? And
where can we find doing excellent. I'm doing excellent. I have just raided the Vault Industries vault and used the Compound V to manifest my time travel and space powers to teleport to 1960s Americana. So I am prepared to go over both these shows. You can find me at Bracey452 on Twitter. That's Bracey 452.
I was about to say, you're just mixing all the timelines.
I'm all about it, man. I'm all about it.
All right. We are going to jump into the Umbrella Academy Season 2, Episode 3, known as The Swedish Job. The Swedish Job. Now, just to give our audience a brief recap of the episode, it's continuing the story of what each one of the individual characters are doing as they hop through where they were placed in the early 1960s and how they're responding to their new lives. But in this episode, we start to get more and more scenes and incidences of them connecting with each other and with them making the connection and filling in each other with the information in terms of what's going on, what's coming, and really what they're going to do about it. And it poses some really, really interesting questions that we're going to get into in a minute. And Allison finds Klaus. Klaus is firmly entrenched in his developing cult. He fakes some flight powers by Ben holding him up, which is really funny. Luther is still absolutely feeling sorry for himself and kind of, once he finds out that Allison is married and has a husband and a life, he just goes deeper into this self-hatred. But Luther acts like he's on drugs, but I guess his love for his sister is his drug. And he has no self-esteem. He doesn't seem to have a purpose outside of loving her. Ray is sprung from prison, and they stage the sit-in, which is an extremely powerful scene. We're going to talk about that. Klaus reconnects with his old partner, David, and they fell in love when they were serving in Vietnam together. This time, Klaus is trying to help him avoid that future and avoid that fate. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about in terms of the theme that this episode brings up. And then there's the huge reveal at the end of the show as to who Lila really is. And I'm trying to tell y'all that she was no good. I hated her on sight. and now we understand why, because she is, of course, the daughter of the handler, and she's just a plant. She's just messing with Diego because the handler, Lila, and the Swedish trio are all after the Umbrella Academy members. And so we want to talk about some very particular scenes. I'm very interested to hear what my co-hosts have to say. Here's the first thing I want to throw out at you, though. We said it last week, so we don't have to do a complete rehash. But the thing about this show is that none of these characters are strong enough on their own to be compelling. What's compelling about them is the overall story. And I explained before that what's compelling about me is Allison's story, because my father told me about that time in this country. And like I said last week, we're there now again in a lot of ways. So that's interesting. That has the strongest historical root. But in terms of the characters themselves, there's just not really a whole lot about them that makes you want to watch them. You kind of want to see what happens to them, except, of course, for Five. So here's the first thing I'm going to throw out to my co-hosts. I want you to pick your favorite character and tell me, if you were writing the show, what you would do to make them more interesting. Just one character. We don't have time to go over all five. But you pick your one favorite character and tell me what type of writing tweak you would do to just make them a little bit more compelling. And I'm going to throw that out first to Bracy.
That's actually a bit tough, because on the show, my favorite character is Five, and Five's pretty darn perfect. I really like this whole idea of, you know, the old guy and the kid's body and him having to deal with that, and the attitude that comes across with him being in that young body, especially as he's jumping through time and dealing with different situations. I gotta say, I'm honestly stumped. I don't really know how I can make the character better. He's pretty good as is.
The thing I would do with Five is I would give us more glimpses of what his actual age body looks like.
Oh, that'd be cool, yeah.
I think they kind of did, but I'll get into that.
Yeah, they did. But I would do that kind of more on a regular thing, kind of like a, you know how when the T-1000 was malfunctioning in T2,
mm-hmm.
you could see the glitch as it morphed back and forth from Robert Patrick to his silver form and it couldn't hold it as solid after it got damaged? I would make Five be like that. Kind of like a reverse Billy Batson thing, to where he turns into his adult self spontaneously and he can't control it. So like he'll never know when he wakes up every day, am I a boy or am I a man? That would be really cool, I think.
That's a good take.
So go ahead, Steve. Let me hear what you think.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk about Five, and I have a feeling that for most of us, the answer is going to be Five. And that's an kind of an interesting idea, but one of the things with this, at least in the context of this particular episode, is that I just feel like Five really isn't doing much other than, okay, we have to gather everybody to stop the apocalypse. And what I feel they kind of dropped the ball with all of them, but especially with Five, because he was there, was that, you know, we never saw much of ramifications from last episode where he got his ass kicked by Pogo. We also never really kind of dealt with Hargreaves this episode either. It just seemed to be more of, okay, we're gathering everybody back together. But we're not like seeing what are the emotional consequences, you know, of, you know, you reached out to this like favorite uncle of yours and he doesn't know you and he beats the hell out of you. And you don't know, you know, how to deal with that. I just feel like the emotional consequences were not even developed with that. And I would have done something a little bit more with that. Also with Diego, because Diego's daddy issues are a big, big part of his character. But at least with Five, I would have liked to have seen, like, you know, where's the emotional part of this? And it's just nowhere, particularly with this episode. It's all kind of plot oriented. Okay, I'm going to save Vanya now. I'm going to go and, you know, talk to Luther and you know, watch him get pummeled, you know, because out of self-pity. You know, but we really are not really seeing any of the weight that this episode could have had in terms of the character depth, in terms of the emotional depth, and that's what I would have added.
Now, that is a really good point, the weight of what they're doing. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Nemesis, go ahead. Pick a character, your favorite character. Pick somebody besides Five and give me a tweak.
Well, I do like Five, but I'm going to hit on two things real quick and then tell you what I would do. My favorite character so far in this season has not been a member of the Umbrella Academy. It's Ray. Ray resonates with me every time he's on the screen, and there really isn't much else I would do with him except just explore his feelings more deeply and give him more screen time. That's what I would do. But I really like Ray, and every time he's on there, I'm very invested on understanding him and knowing what he's feeling with all of what's going on around him. You know, not only in the world, but with his wife, and then when he's finding out about this new world. So there's that. You know, and then I talked a little bit about Five. You know, Five is Five. The thing for me, even though this is my favorite character, I wish that they would do more with Klaus. And I wish that they gave him more of the powers from the series, but I also wish he had more ramifications for his decisions, because I think it would be very interesting. And especially, that's especially true in this episode, where he is trying to change someone else's future and his past. And I would love to see him suffer some sort of ramifications or mind bending or something because of it, because he's warned a man he's going to be lovers with in the future about his possible future. And this man hasn't known him yet, but is going to meet him in the future. So he'll know. I mean, you start to wrap your mind around the time paradox of that and what it could do with realities and what it could do to Klaus's mind and everything. I think there was some real meat left on the bone there that they could have done something with, and it would have been really interesting.
I have a short introduction for that. What if he succeeds in changing his future and saves him, but the consequences is that they never get together in the future?
Right, right. And so then how does that marry to Klaus's past?
Yeah.
You know? Then what is going on? How does that reconcile in your brain? I mean, there's so many things you could do with it, and it would have been really interesting and fascinating, because Klaus is doing the big no-no. He's screwing around with time, and I would have loved to have seen him have to deal with the ramifications of that.
Okay, you guys always do that. You always go to my next question before I ask it, but that's okay. So let me tell you what I would do, and then we'll go to that question. What I would do besides Five, I would go with Vanya, because Vanya's scenes are always really kind of flat. You know what I would do with Vanya? I would Anakin Skywalker her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, I would make her start to get drunk off her power and not a full split personality like Caitlin and Killer Frost, but more, I kind of like it. I'm kind of intoxicated by it. Why do I have to keep suppressing it? You know, and she does kind of get there, but it would be more of a...
Dark Phoenix?
Yes, it would be more of a, you see her turning evil is too cliche at this point, but you definitely see her start to embrace what she can really do and what that could really mean. And because when Jean turned, it was, why do I have to stay bound by the morals and ethics of mere humans? Because I'm not that anymore. And that's what I would do with Vanya, just in a very kind of subtle way. Mm. Like a drug. Like, you know, she took a little taste, she took a little hit, and she liked it more than she thought. But she's not quite ready to, you know, let everybody else know that, you know, it's really intoxicating to her, that kind of thing. Because most of her scenes are, like, really, really flat. They're just, like, I don't know. And Ellen Page is a better actress than most of the time what they're giving her on the show, at least so far. So, but anyway, so let's go to my next point, which we already started to talk about. I'm going to add extra question, too. You guys already started to talk about it. I want to dive deeper into that. I want to dive deeper into what we were talking about with Klaus and David. Because there really should be more consequences, like you guys were saying about how we're so used to the warnings that come along with sci-fi about messing with the time stream, until when we're thrown in a situation where it seems like it's not that big of a deal or it's selective, it causes cognitive dissonance. Like, we're like, wait, where are the consequences? So let's deep dive into that and tell me what you think the consequences would be. And I'm going to add an additional question, which is, what would you do if you had the same opportunity? Like, if you've lost a parent, or like, let's say there was an accident when you're in high school and your best friend died or got crippled, and you had a chance to go back, or you were on the battlefield or something, if you lost somebody, what would you do if you were Klaus? What would you do in that situation? So let's first talk about the overall story world ramifications. Because I agree completely with you, Nemesis. The mind warping possibilities of what he's doing, just, you know, because so many things are tied into our decisions. You know, just having kids and being in one city when he should have been in another. And, you know, and of course, Seated on the Edge of Forever with the original series exemplifies all that about how things have to happen a certain way or there's devastation. So let's deep dive into that. Tell me more again, how you think the consequences should go. What should they be? What would you like to see? And then we'll get over into what you would do given the same situation. Go ahead, Steve. You start.
Okay. As far as the consequences in the story world, I really do think that, yeah, Klaus really does have to change really does have to suffer or some sort of consequences, because one of his big problems is that, you know, he's always doing all kinds of stupid stuff and he never seems to pay very much for it. He's usually protected in some way. So I think that that's one of the reasons why I kind of threw out the idea of, okay, you can save this guy. But, you know, but at the cost of everything that you loved, because he needs to face something like this, so he can start at least confronting his own actions. I'm a big believer in confronting them with their own stupid decisions all the time. And I think that Klaus definitely needs that. In terms, though, of the question about, would I save somebody? I'm not going to deny that, you know, there are people I definitely would love to have around that I don't now. And there's definitely from an emotional level. Yeah, absolutely. There are people I would love to save if I could. But we've seen too many time travel stories gone wrong. We've seen too many instances of, you know, going back to change the future. And, you know, it might feel good at the time. But then the long-term consequences are, the world ends in 20 years. And it doesn't necessarily have to be anything that apocalyptic. The problem is you never know what the consequences of changing anything is. Because once you put somebody back on the board that was scheduled to die, how does they change things? Look at City on the Edge of Forever, where, you know, Captain Kirk had to let Edith Keeler die, because if she didn't, the Nazis win World War II. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't know what you're changing. And I would say, unless you know exactly what you're changing and what exactly the consequences are, my feeling is you've got to let time work the way it is, because it could change the world around you. It could change everyone you know and your relationships with you. It can change your own past and who you become. If you're not careful, there's just too many ways to screw up everything with time travel, including the world itself. It's just not worth the risk unless you know what you're doing.
Have you seen that movie Time Freak with Sophie Turner?
I have not.
I just watched it on one of my sleepless nights, and it's dealing with this very thing, because her boyfriend, and they break up early in the movie, and he invents a time machine to get her back. And he goes back an unlimited number of times. It's like a Groundhog Day thing. Mm-hmm. He just keeps doing it until he gets it right. Mm-hmm. And he ends up killing her soul. So by the time he gets to the future that they thought they wanted, she doesn't feel anything. Mm-hmm. And she's like, we never fight. Why don't we fight? Because he fixes all the fights. And she's like, I'm dying. I don't care about nothing. Which I thought was brilliant. Execution wasn't great, but I thought the idea was good. Go ahead, Nemesis. More of a deep dive into consequences, and then tell me what you would do if you had the chance.
Sure. I would say if I was writing this and writing Klaus, I would make him, every time he does something like this, it fractures his reality. And so he has to deal with multiple realities, multiple memories of multiple realities at the same time, which would lead to psychosis. And insanity until you rectify it, you know. And so every time you make one of these decisions, having to deal with it would almost be like being the Joker. You know, it's like you don't know what your past really is, and it would drive you insane because you don't know what's fact and what's fiction in your own past. Or maybe they're all fact, you know? And I would explore that. I think it would be really interesting. As far as for me personally, I think it really depends on when in life you're hitting me and how much wisdom I had at that point in my life. I've thought about this. You know, in my personal life, I ended up getting sick and had to leave West Point and then come back for a year. And then that ended up making me disabled. And there's times that I wish that hadn't happened. But when I really think about it, if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have met my wife. I wouldn't have my children that I have now. I probably would still be in the military because I wouldn't have become disabled. And I wouldn't be on this podcast and a lot of other stuff. Mm-hmm. So all of the good things that have happened in my life, all of the bad things that happened in my life, you know, I'm middle aged, so I've had wisdom and time to think about it. They all add up to me and my life, and I'm happy with it. So I think wisdom has given me the insight to know that I wouldn't screw around with anything in my past, even if I could.
Very, very profound. Go ahead, Bracey.
I think with Klaus that they are going to go that route. You know, there's just not enough to do that in this episode. Plus, he hasn't really changed the timeline yet. But I feel like it's coming. Nobody in this show really seems to get away with stuff, if you know what I mean by that. You know, they're all kind of victims of their flaws. So I think they're going to get to that point with Klaus. Like, while Klaus does seem to get away with a lot of stuff, he's not really. He's still suffering in his own way. It's just not as it's not as out there as somebody like Luthor, where he just wears his pain right on his sleeve. You know, Klaus kind of runs away from it, but he's still suffering from it. So I think Klaus will, if he goes down that road, he's going to end up paying for it somehow. As for me, I have thought about this innumerable times as a longtime reader of comic books and science fiction. One of my favorite mental exercises, as mentioning this like to one of my role playing groups, is like I sometimes watch role playing events online, like Critical Role and LA by Night. You know, I watch TV shows and I read books. And one of the things I find myself doing quite a lot is I inject myself or a character that I would want to be in these stories. And I start thinking about, like, what would I do in this situation? How would I deal with that? Or how would my character deal with that? And so I've postulated this sort of thing to myself quite a bit. And it's like Nemesis said, at this stage of my life, I have enough wisdom to know better than to not mess with the timeline, even if it was going to be grossly painful to me not to do so. For the similar reasons, I think, like, you know, I've had a lot of terrible things happen in my life, but would I have met my wife if I wasn't on a particular sort of track through my life? The thing I would find far more tempting, I think, than necessarily trying to save somebody in my life, I think would be to go back and fix my own mistakes. That is a powerful, powerful temptation, you know, because you have with age comes wisdom, and hindsight's 20/20. It's like, oh, if I could go back in my own timeline and kind of make myself better and still try and game the systems, like, oh, I still want to meet my wife here. I still got, like, but, you know, it's not going to work because I'm not going to be the same person I was when I met her. And when it comes to time travel, I typically see three things. Either you completely screw up the timeline. Timelines are robust and they fix themselves. So no matter what tweaks you do, the time ends up working itself out. Or you fracture reality and you end up with divergent realities. And none of those situations ever works out for the person who's doing it. Look, leave time travel to the doctor. He's the only one who knows what are fixed points in time, and we don't.
Yep.
I would also add the other situation, like going back to fix one little thing or a mistake you made, you end up with the third situation, which is often what Rip Hunter finds himself in, where he thinks he's just going to pull this one little thread. And then that thread leads to another thread.
The thread's always connected to something.
Right. And he ends up unraveling the whole thing, you know, so.
Yes. All of that makes sense now. If I were writing Klaus, first of all, Nemesis, I love your Joker slow insanity idea. What I would do is I would make Klaus like he's the only one that can hear Ben. I would make him morph back and forth between the old timeline and the new one. Mm. It's something he had no control over. Mm-hmm. And as he experienced both, he kind of gets caught between the two. If you remember in the original Flashpoint comic, when Barry got to the new future, he had those headaches because the old memories were leaving.
Mm-hmm. And then so it started collapsing in on him. So.
Yes. And I would make it something like that to where he's experiencing both timelines simultaneously. I could explain that to someone. And so, yeah.
If you guys read the Dark Tower series by Stephen King?
Somewhat.
Yeah, there's a character in there named Jake who Roland the Gunslinger lets die in the first book, and he's alive on another world because, you know, there's this multiplicity kind of thing going on. Mm-hmm. But he's stuck with two distinct memories in his head, and it's driving him crazy.
Yeah. So I would love to see that just to give Klaus something else to focus on other than just being so high so I don't have to be in pain and Ben. Yeah. Because looking at a future you created or looking at your own future is going to affect, again, more of what you do. Now, if it were me, I, like you guys, I have thought about this over and over and over and over and over again. What would I do if I had a chance? And the thing I keep coming up with is I can't because of my kids.
Mm-hmm.
If I went back and fixed my mistakes, if I went back and changed certain things, if I went back and changed my relationships or circumstances, whatever, I'm like, but then the kids I have would never exist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that's not fair to them.
Yeah.
You know, how can you know? That's like Tuvix on Voyager. Like, I'd be taking away their life for, you know, giving a different one to me. And then, do I keep the memory?
Yeah.
So I remember my daughter and my son, but I'll never see them again. I'll never see them in that form because I changed how everything happened.
I mean, that's like a special kind of hell right there. So.
Yeah. I'm like, I can't because, you know, being a single parent really changed my life. As you guys were talking about how everything we go through really shapes us.
Mm-hmm.
But being a single parent really, really changed me for the better. I would not be the man I am now had I not had my single parent experience.
I mean, think about this paradox. Even if you manage to meet your wife at the appropriate time, it's like, oh, you know, I'm going to go woo her. I managed to do all that. Who's to say you guys get pregnant at the same time? You might end up with two completely different kids.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And so I'm like, I just couldn't do it.
I think it's definitely one of those things that, you know, it's cliche, and if you had told me at 22, I probably wouldn't have believed you, but, you know, when you get to your 40s and your 50s, you know, or whatever it is, you really do get some wisdom. It's surprising. You would never could have convinced me that I would get some wisdom, you know, but, you know, you start to understand that every person's life is this weird mixture of pain and happiness, and you know, it all adds up to whatever it is that your life turned out to be. But, you know, sometimes you got to have that pain to have the other good stuff you had, too. So.
Yeah, you got to be like McCoy in Star Trek IV. Don't take away my pain.
I need my pain.
Oh, Kirk, yeah, Kirk. Like, I need my pain. It makes me who I am.
Well, let me throw in a little commercial here, even though it's kind of soapboxy. But we can get soapboxy. Soapboxy is good for you sometimes. Let me throw in my little commercial about how this is why science fiction and fantasy and comic books have a real world impact, because they make you think in ways you might not have thought before, and they make you understand the tapestry of time and the ripple effect, the echo effect, the alternate future effect. All that stuff is science fiction, but it does really make you think about, if I could retrace my steps. You know, I have thought millions of times about what if my dad was still alive? what would I do if I had my father back? But I also realize, what would that mean for his life? Maybe I'm being selfish. Maybe when he stepped over onto the other side, maybe he was so happy to be free of his mortal frame. Why would I drag him away from his joy? You know, you just realize so many decisions are selfish. And so it's just really something. It's really something. So when I watch this episode and look at the show, I'm like, there needs to be bigger ripples, just kind of all the way around, because none of them should be there. But anyway, next thing I want to talk about is we need to talk about the scene. And the scene in the diner when there's the African-American sit-in and everybody's standing around shouting them down, get out, get out, get out. Things turn violent and they're putting their lives on the line and they're demanding service. And they're demanding to be treated like human beings. And why can't we be waited on like regular customers? And as you're colored and we don't serve your people here and blah, 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 blah. And we'll get off into Allison a little bit after that. But I want to talk about that scene because I really want to hear your perspective on it. There's just so many different layers to that scene because that scene is obviously historical and accurate in terms of the context. And it's ironically very relevant to where we are now in 2020. But I felt like it was done so powerfully and done so well. And I felt it on a visceral level. I felt the yelling. I felt the stares. I felt the food. I felt the handcuffs. I felt the beatings. I felt them. I didn't just watch them. I felt them. It was just so powerful for me personally. And I don't know. It was just kind of heart-stopping for me. And I also thought about, you know, what we just talked about. What if something happens because Allison's there that changes the movement?
Yeah.
And what if all of a sudden, you know, everything goes off the rails because of something that ended up happening because she was there that wouldn't have happened before, and then everything changes. Now, I don't know if you guys know, but there was a theory. I don't know how legit it was, but there was a theory that Dr. King, before he died, was starting to change his mind about nonviolence. And he was starting to move much more towards Malcolm X's position. I don't know if you've ever heard that. And he was thinking about maybe the nonviolent way wasn't the answer. Maybe they should take up arms. Maybe they should fight back. And I've talked to people that were alive during that time, and they said it was the sight of all those black people being beat up upon and them not fighting back and keeping their dignity that changed their hearts. And that's why the Civil Rights Act got passed, precisely because of the nonviolent protest angle. So what if that goes away and all of a sudden it becomes a race war with violence on both sides? And that's what I was thinking. I was like, is that what's going to happen? Because Allison's there. You know, so anyway, so give me your thoughts on that scene. I was very moved by it. Like I said, I felt it on every level, and I was thinking about the ramifications if something went horribly wrong. So let me know what you thought. Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, that's a really deep subject. I mean, there are, you know, if we ever wanted to do like a history podcast, I've read some of that. I've also read a lot about the thinking behind, you know, with Kennedy and then LBJ and a bunch of other stuff. So, but I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole because that's a long discussion. But this scene, it really brought something out in me. I mean, everybody who's listened to this podcast, I think you could guess that I'm a fairly easygoing guy and I'm very slow to anger. But I'm a different person when I get into fighting mode. You know, I get quiet and angry. And that's what this scene did to me. I mean, it really affected me. I'm sitting there watching it, and I had, for some of you guys, had clenched teeth and clenched fists. And I was ready to go beat some ass. Period. I mean, that's basically the way it was. I was watching this, and It gave me a newfound respect, even though I already had a respect for that movement. It gave me a newfound respect for the self-control and discipline to sit there in the face of that, because I'm sitting here in 2020 in my bedroom watching this show, and I'm ready to go and start kicking some ass and taking some names. And these folks lived that and dealing with stuff like that for real. And so that to me was the power of this scene, is that it brought it home even more for me, and I very much appreciated it.
Yeah, so powerful. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot, I think, to add. This was a really, really powerful scene. They could have messed this up any number of ways. They could have gone completely over the top with it and lost us. But instead, I think they played it at just the right pitch, at just the right pacing, as the tensions escalate and then eventually blow up. And the way that it's done is really, really believably done. And I've kind of felt this was probably the most believable scene, and actually the most believable subplot in the entire episode that we saw today. I really was brought in, you know, by the struggles that they had there, you know, how, you know, but at the same time, you sort of wonder, okay, you know, yeah, there may be a point with, okay, the people that own the store, you know, have certain property rights, but at the same time, you're denying the rights of these people who have every reason to be there. And you sort of sympathize with these people coming in, you know, and you become a lot less sympathetic towards those people as they get more and more racist, as they get more and more belligerent, as they resort to more and more violence to try to get rid of these people who are just there for, you know, ideally to be served. And eventually just kind of gets to the point where you're just horrified and disgusted by everything that's going on. And you just sympathize with these poor people that are just standing up for their rights. And it's just really, really beautifully done.
Yeah. I mean, whatever you feel in your heartstrings, man, this really tugs at them no matter what angle you see it from. Go ahead, Bracey.
First of all, I think Allison might have actually interfered with the timeline at this point. When she demonstrates her powers to save her husband, and he's completely horrified and broken by this, mm-hmm. I think that historically, had the Umbrella Academy not fallen through time, I think he might have been, in that timeline, one of the great leaders of the movement. He's definitely got the Dr. King vibe. So I think this is why, historically, we don't remember him in the context of the show, that this breaks him. It takes him completely out of everything that he was doing, because he's lost when he sees what she does. He's just lost. Now, going back to the moment in the diner, I watched Watchmen a while back, and a lot of Watchmen was built on this theme of racism, and it even had a very dramatic opening scene for an episode where they had the area formerly known as Black Wall Street, and how it was attacked by a bunch of racists, to the point where they even used somebody hired an airplane, was, you know, literally dropping bombs on the area. Now, the way that played, though, didn't affect me even a tenth as much as this diner scene did, because there's just so many things going on in this. It looks like a scene out of a war movie. It looks a little too much. It's not grounded. You know, you had things like instead of the mother running with the child, the father's carrying the child and the mother's carrying the shotgun. Just a lot of weird little incongruencies that just didn't make sense in the scene. So I couldn't relate to it on the same emotional level. Now, I watch this scene in this diner and I go through a plethora of emotions, including a little bit of shame, even though I have no relation to this as a person. This is not something that I've did or anything I know in my line did, but you see this happening, and the actors portraying the white folks, like the vitriol, the sheer pure down deep in your heart hate that they were expressing. It was like just so ugly to me, just like I was actually surprised at how deeply it affected me, like just how shocking it was, because, you know, I'm 52, and so I remember certain things from history. I wasn't alive for this, but I remember how attitudes about certain types of people were back in the 80s and even in the 70s. So I've seen a progression of history. I've seen how things have changed. And looking back on this instance in this show and thinking of how things are now, and I'm like, man, things are so much better. Like, and, you know, not to get too political about it, but I feel like there's people who are complaining about stuff that, like, you don't even know, man. You don't even know. Like, go back to something like this. So just to see that there was a time in history when white people just literally, viscerally, deep in their bones, hated their black neighbors like this was just disgusting and sickening. And it's amazing how well they did this scene that it got that much of a reaction out of me. So, like, you know, round of applause to the people who put all that together, because they got exactly what they wanted. They got a deeply emotional response.
Yeah, we really have to give the writers, directors, actors, lighters, makeup people, anybody that put the scene together, we really have to give them solid credit.
I think I would want to add one thing to my comments, which was, and to what Jeff was just saying, which was, it was so well done, but it wasn't overblown, because I've read historical accounts of what happened in these types of things, and this is what happened. But there's a difference between reading it and seeing it.
Yeah, especially to people who don't resist, who don't fight back. You know, the same tactics that Gandhi used to shame the British Empire into backing down is what's going on here. And it's a tough thing to do, but damn, it's effective.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, both are true. Tough to do, but really effective. Now, keying in on something that Frazee said, let me tell you what I was thinking. I was thinking that this guy becomes the Bolivar Trask of this story world.
Hmm.
Can you imagine after seeing Allison do what she did?
Oh, wow.
He's so freaked out until he develops this world's version of Sentinels. Can you imagine?
God knows. Yeah, I mean, because, like, you know, we've all seen these situations as writers in many a show, like when you find out, like, oh, you know, our whole life together is a lie. I can never trust anybody again. It's like, but no, I had to lie. I've got these superpowers. How am I supposed to tell you I fell through time? Like, but, you know, it's too late on one person's side when their worldview, their whole paradigm is shifted so far to one end, they can never quite come back.
Right, that's exactly right. So let's talk about that as we wrap this segment up. So that's the last thing I wanted to talk about before we do that last little dip on Lila. I'll talk about her. You can hear my enthusiasm in that. Anyway, but this thing about Allison finally revealing her powers, I have to give her credit as a character for her self-control up until this point. Because I would have snapped way before this, so I got to give her a props for that. But in so doing, you know, she's got the woman thing. She's got the person of color thing. She has now the mutant thing that's kind of all out there. Different people see her in different ways, but she's got all that she's dealing with. And so I wanted your feedback on, should she have done that? We just talked about what we would do given a chance to go back, and all of us said kind of uniformly that there's just no way we could justify that. And I think Steve said, you need to know what you're changing.
Yeah.
So should Allison have done that? Because she saved his life, but set off some other things. Should she have stood there and let her husband get arrested and beaten to death? Or should she have done what she did? I'll chime in last. Let me hear what you think. Start with Steve.
I think it's emotionally understandable. The problem really is with this is that the reason that he went there finally was because she was there, and he was having all this these doubts and issues about her because of what he had been told earlier, because of his conversations with Luther and Klaus. The way the time would have gone, you know, he would have led them there himself. Maybe he might have been beaten. Maybe he wouldn't have been. But the reason he got taken by the cops was because he got overly emotional, which I kind of felt was a little out of character for him, and allowed himself to get taken away because he was so busy trying to call his wife out on things that, frankly, he should have waited until much later to talk about. Sure. Like, you know, if you want to go and talk with your wife about the family that she didn't know, that you didn't know about, the time to do that is not during a demonstration where both of you are in real danger. I kind of felt like that I felt like he would have known better than that. And that was one of the reasons why I was disappointed with the ending. But in terms of the decision that she made, it's a very, very tough call. And I can't say that I fault her for doing that, at least on an emotional level. You know, she committed to him. She saved him. What is she going to do? Let him die? She doesn't know, I mean, necessarily that his death is going to influence things one way or another. Maybe his death ends up causing problems because it's his death that inspires people to be violent. You know, she doesn't know that. So I would say in that situation, not knowing the outcome, you know, somebody that you care about, you know, being in mortal danger for his life, I can understand it. I can understand it. It's very much a potential damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. But erring on the side of saving someone is not necessarily a bad thing to me.
Very interesting. Go ahead, Bracey.
I'll tell you, just kind of at that point, you're kind of in for a penny, in for a pound, because the very fact that you know, knowing that you're displaced in time, and if you know anything about, you know, the theories of time travel as a science fiction fan or writer, your immediate response to just go to be a hermit somewhere until you can figure out how to, you know, either get back to where you belong or just do as little as you can to the timeline as possible. But the very fact that she adopted a life in here and she married a man, a prominent man in this society, she's already affected the timeline. There's a thing in science that talks about just even the act of observing a phenomenon, you affect the phenomenon. And they've done quantum studies, quantum level studies, to show like you can, a scientist can literally affect the outcome of an experiment just by observing it. Somehow the quantum level reacts in that way. So at that point, since she's already gone that far in, she's already married this dude, she's already part of the community, she might as well just save her husband's life. I know, like, it, like we talked about, like, not messing with the timeline, it'd be easier to know, like, I remember the Doctor Who episode where, like, what's her name, the first girl in the new series, like, her father gets run over by a car.
Oh, Father's Day is the one you're thinking of.
Yeah. That's kind of easier to watch than watching someone you love get brutally beat to death. I don't think I would have the fortitude for that. You know, if they get hit by a car, I can kind of like shut my eyes and not see it happen. But like, I couldn't watch somebody just, you know, spread my wife's brains all over the pavement. Nah, not happening.
Okay. Yeah. You have to feel in the moment, but look at the future.
Yeah, tough call.
Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I don't think Rumor is really, what do they call her here? Allison?
Yeah.
Is really concerned about the future at all, or she's thinking about it. I think she's one of the most grounded characters in the Umbrella Academy, her and Five. I think her main concern is she's literally scared of herself and her power. And this all goes back to what happened, what she did with her daughter and the ramifications of that. And I think that's always in the back of her mind.
Mm.
She's absolutely scared to use her power and scared of how much power she really has and unlocking that Pandora's box within herself at temptation. Because she literally has the ability to make anybody do anything they want. And, you know, it's that in for a penny, in for a pound type thing. You start going down that road and, you know, you start with little things and then eventually you're telling somebody to slit their throat or something, you know, something really, really horrible. So I think she's scared of that. And it took something like this to bring her to user power because she was faced with two really horrible decisions for her, but you know, as far as one thing she's very scared of and one thing that she's terrified of, which is her husband getting beat to death in front of her. And so it made the decision, I think, probably rather easy for her to do, because, you know, at that point she had to choose between saving her, this man that she loves, or letting him be beat while possibly saving herself some guilt or shame or something, which was not even a choice for her. So I think that's really where her mind was on that. Refresh my memory, though. What was it that she told the cop to do? Did she simply tell him to
I stop? Heard a rumor that you walked away.
You walked away, yes.
Okay. See, and I think that shows how grounded she is in the wisdom, because a less grounded or less wise character would say, I heard a rumor, you walked away and kept walking until your feet bled to the bone or something like that.
It's funny, when I saw the scene, like, my thought was, like, I heard a rumor you had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, any number of things like that. So I think she still got that in her head. She's still worried about it. And it's still that in for a penny, in for a pound type thing. You know, it's like, if I let this little demon loose inside of me and give it a foothold, it's going to keep growing. And so she's constantly on alert for that because of what happened in her past.
That makes a lot of sense. My take on it was, there's no way you could love someone and stand there and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, who was it that rescued her? Told her to get out of there. Was it Klaus?
Yeah.
If Klaus had shown up before that happened and drug her away, and she didn't have to see that, then I don't think she would have run back. I think she would have kept going with her brother. But because she was there when it began to happen and she saw it from start to finish, you can't stand there looking in the face of someone you love and do nothing. You just couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't blame her. I don't fault her. And, you know, I would have reacted the same way. That was someone that I loved, and I had the power to stop that from happening to them. Then, yeah, I use it. No way. I just could not find that in myself to do nothing if I had the power to stop it.
But, you know, my question to all of you would be, put yourself in her position, or put yourself in her position at a moment in your time when you are less grounded or less wise. Would you have simply told the cop to walk away, or would you have been tempted to tell him to do something else to himself? So.
Yeah, I told you, my gut reaction was to give him a heart attack.
Yeah.
I heard a rumor your head exploded.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wouldn't have been something as simple as them walking away. Plus, I would not have just localized my influence.
Mm-hmm.
I would have rumored as many people as I could.
Right.
But some of them, they definitely would have met an unfortunate end. Some of them, I would have said, I heard a rumor that you really love black people.
That's the best rumor I've ever heard.
Dude, that's awesome. I totally thought for a moment you were going to go all Death Note on them.
Yeah. And
it would have been some of them.
And but, I think the I mean, it's trite, but it's I think it pertains here, is with rumor, I think the thing you really always have to keep in the back of your mind is that old saying, which is power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. She has absolute power, and I think she understands that.
Well, dude, she knows she's a step away from being the purple man.
Yeah.
She's basically a more restrained version of Vanya. Vanya can't control what she has, and and Allison is trying to be as controlled as possible with it.
Absolutely.
Yes, 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 yes to all of that. But I definitely would have, even with the other thing, the not so good suggestions, I would have gone around rumoring as many people as I could and telling them, you love black people.
That would be so great.
And then I would have planted some seeds of love. Don't know how long her power effect lasts, but I would have planted some seeds of love and given people something new to think about and let them experience life without all that hatred in their souls. And then who knows, when the spell wore off, who knows? Maybe they would have liked
Yeah, they'll have to do some deep reflection after that.
Yeah. I heard a rumor that you went back and rethought your life, and, you know, you would think about, you know, what you're doing to black people.
Yeah. Maybe once you had a taste of maybe not hating all the time, because hating all the time is very tiring. Maybe would have said, you know what? Maybe I don't want to go back to that life.
See, but then the writer in me, and this is a whole long discussion, so I don't want to sidetrack this, but the writer in me is seeing always that I could turn that back on Allison and make it turn out bad.
Easily. It's a literal genie power, so you have to be very, very careful about the exact wording.
Yeah, so.
Now that is perfectly said, Steve. It's a genie power. And we all know that whatever you wish for, there's some stuff you wasn't thinking about when you wish for it.
Yep.
And monkey's paw, man.
It's like that Twilight Zone episode where the genie comes out and he gives you exactly what you said, the way that you said it, and takes the worst possible interpretation that fits the wording.
Yep.
That's right. Remember that, kids, if you ever wish for superpowers, you have to wish for the secondary powers.
Yeah.
You can't just wish for super speed. You got to wish for the aura that stops friction, or you're only going to run fast one time. But anyway, on that note, we're going to take a break on this segment. Obviously, there's so much here we could go on with. We're going to take a quick break. We want you to hear from our sponsors. We want you to check out some of the other things we have going on the United Capes Podcast Network. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back in 5.
Coming soon, on October 24th, 2020, Comic Crusaders presents Virtual Con 2, only on ComicCrusaders.com.
All right, folks, welcome back from the break. We're going to jump in on The Boys, Season 2, Episode 3, that has a very long and unwieldy title. It's called... Over the Hill with the Swords of 1,000 Men. That comes from a comic with that title, and also it's a line from a song. We'll see how it plays out in the episode. To give you, our audience, a brief recap, a lot of different things come to a head in this episode, which is what makes it so much fun. They release the first three all together. And so one of the things this show does very well is it gives you some type of emotional payoff for what you've been following and then sets up the next thing. It does that extremely well. So many shows nowadays, you have to wait and wait and wait and wait. And by the time you get there, you're so tired, you don't care anymore. But that's not what The Boys does. So in this episode, we get a resolution of the Kenji arc, Kimiko's brother, and everything that means going forward. And it's revelatory for who Storm Freddy is, and it sets the tone for so many things that we're going to see and hope to see as the season plays out. We see more of Homelander enjoying his family, but we also see more that Homelander has to have everybody love him. Maeve has to love him. His newfound son has to love him. He really still wants Becca to love him. You know, he was dealing with Doppelganger because he still wanted, you know, what's her name, Elizabeth Shue's character. She's dead, but, you know, he still wants that. So it's like his niece knows no bounds. And that's why Stormfront is the perfect foil. This is the episode where we get a really clear look at Stormfront, her powers, her personality, and her relationship to Homelander. And that's really something. Now, I also have to point out, in this episode, the story world really loses a step. And I know my co-hosts know exactly what I'm talking about. We're going to talk about that in a minute. We're going to deep dive into that. But they really have kind of lost a step, and I'll set that up in a minute when we talk about what it is, which is kind of real in the show, but it's clearly a misstep, at least from the writer code point of view. And so we get all that going on, and then Starlight has to make a moral choice. She has to choose between Huey's life, or both her and Huey's life, and she chooses Huey's life, and then Butcher makes a choice. and stops that from happening, which I thought was really interesting. Really interesting what would have happened if Butcher hadn't been there or hadn't said anything. How that would have played out. Maeve also is making a choice with her girlfriend in terms of how they're going to handle being a couple and what that really means. Finally, what happens in this episode is Stan Edgar is the consummate. I mean, I thought, you know, Stillwell's character was great, but Stan Edgar is the consummate corporate politician. He knows how to spin the perspective. He knows how to use the talking points. He knows how to use code words. He knows how to shift focus. He uses sleight of hand like a master magician. He does so many things to make the chaos going on around him work in his favor, and it's brilliant. Giancarlo, as always, is such a brilliant actor, but this is a brilliant character. And he does what he does so well. And of course, the Deep has another scene that reinforces again that he's a loser. And even when he tries to win, he loses. And I'm going to talk, if we have time, I'm going to talk about how I feel about that. But I'm going to get into some stuff with my co-host. The first thing I actually want to talk about is the writing missed up. And I know they already know what it is, but I'm going to throw it out there for our audience, and then I want to hear their thoughts about it. There's two things that this season so far has really made a serious misstep on. Number one is exposing Compound V too soon. Third episode in, and all of a sudden, all this stuff is going around the world. Everybody knows the heroes are made and not born, and the reason that's a writing misstep is because of the mystique, because of the religious angle, because of the belief. Remember, that was the root of Starlight's character. Now, I know they were making fun of the evangelical conservatives. I know that was the point of a pro character last season. But there was the idea of what do you do when you feel like you've been chosen and ordained by God, and then you find out it's science gone bad. And there's so much more to be explored there that now just kind of seems gone. And then the whole tension of the public finding out, that was a big deal. And now it just seems kind of, I don't know, that's misstep number one. Misstep number two is that the whole original premise is that the Seven were beloved by the public. That they were like, you know, they were straight parodies of the Justice League. And that whenever they showed up, people clapped and cheered because justice was going to be done and we're going to be saved and we feel safe when you're around. And it was holding up that image that was their entire focus, because it wasn't true. It was nothing but an image, but with a carefully constructed image. And we could see the truth. We could see the duplicity, but the general public absolutely loved them, just like we would love Superman and Wonder Woman were they real. And now all of a sudden, that's turned on a dime, mainly because of this found footage of Homeland taking out a terrorist, but also injuring a civilian in the process, and all of a sudden, you know, and so they've got to deal with that. But those are two huge, huge steps off of the original premise, because to me, the tension was greater. The general public thought they were just the best thing ever, and we knew that they were creeps. But now, a little bit more of a, you know, other people starting to find out. Now that's been tarnished. It's not the same. And the whole tension of faith versus science, versus empirical evidence, lies versus truth, was all wrapped up in Compound V being a well-kept secret. And now it's just out. So I really feel like that those two things weren't the right way to go. They really kind of undercut so much of the whole purpose, because now they're just scene after scene after scene of heroes behaving badly. And it was better when it was heroes behaving heroically in public and badly kind of off to the side, at least from my point of view. So we're going to start there, and I'd like to hear what my co-hosts have to say about those two points. Start with Grayson.
Yeah, I have to agree, man. Like, this felt so rushed. And like you said, this was a big deal. This was supposed to be a big shakeup deal. Now, I understand that the CEO has got his big ulterior, sneaky, diabolical plan, whatever. I understand he's got that going on. I understand, like Giancarlo, he's got everything under control, or at least he thinks he does. But yeah, all these cool plot points that you just mentioned have just all been brushed under the rug now. Like, we're just going to kind of get rid of it. But this is a big, big deal, especially because, as you mentioned, first season, they made it very clear, very, very clear, that the majority of people thought that this was some sort of blessing from God. That, like, or even if you didn't believe in God per se, you might have thought, like, you know, somehow life chose me. You know, like, I got the genetic lottery, you know, the cosmos picked me. Whatever your system was, that's where it went. And to have that exposed would have major ramifications, and not just for Vought. All we see is it affecting Vought stock, all this sort of stuff. You know, they're worried about that. But, like, we should see news flashes about, you know, man on the street interviews. How do you feel? It's like, oh, you know, I just don't know if I can believe in heroes anymore and stuff like that. And other people going, yeah, it doesn't matter as long as they're still good. We should see stuff like that. And then, of course, I just brain farted. What was the second deal you brought up?
Compound V being exposed.
I agree with that. Not only should that – has that come too fast, but the fact that we've got Compound V exposed. So – and this might be part of his master plan, but again, it feels a little too weird. If you're criminals on the street, well, what are you going to want to do? You're tired of Homelander, like, screwing up your party. You're going to go try and find some of this Compound B right away. So there's going to be, like, a huge push for rich and powerful people, criminal people, terrorists, as we've already shown the world. They're all going to be rushing to get this stuff. It is going to be chaos, absolute chaos. We should see something demonstrating all that, but instead this episode was a bit of a misstep with I felt like we spent a little too much time on the boat when we could have been having scenes like this showing what's going on in the larger world, because these were huge deals, and they should have been handled like huge deals. I didn't like the way it just got swept under the rug so easily.
Yes, so very quickly. Go ahead, Steve, what do you think?
I think there was a missed opportunity early on. Mainly in the fact that who's to say that Vought doesn't own the media? And if so, if they have a lot of influence on them, and I feel like as a company they should, because they're entrenched in politics, they're deeply involved in foreign policy and things like that. You would think that, and media is a corporation. So I'm just sort of wondering, why is a media corporation going along with exposing Vought? Wouldn't that cost them a lot of money? I mean, even for a short-term story, I'm just sort of like, I'm surprised that Vought is not enough on it with their PR, you know, that maybe they could have gotten to these people as soon as they found out that this had been released to the media and silenced the story. And if they had done that, I mean, that would have put the boys and Starlight in a really bad place, because nothing would have, in that case, would have been gained. But they had to kind of show this whole thing so they could show Giancarlo Esposito's Edgar character being really brilliant. And yeah, he is. But I kind of feel like the long term consequences of this don't work, because I feel like this should have been something that the boys should have been able to have fought for themselves, or with or without Starlight's help, towards the end of the season. And it should have been like a long term thing to getting it out. And instead, it seems like they blew their load a little too soon with that. And so, yeah, that doesn't make sense. As far as the science versus faith aspect of this, you know, that's really interesting, and that's another thing that they could have explored. Because, you know, some people, I mean, especially if they believe that deeply, they're going to believe the lie, even if they're told the truth. At least a percentage of them will. And they might even find ways to rationalize it, you know, saying, oh, well, you know, it is still God. It's just that God is acting through the scientists, you know, or some other kind of rationalization, you know, that allows them to continue their belief in heroes. Because it takes a lot to shatter faith. I mean, it's not going to necessarily take just one big thing to do it. It will for some people. It will for a good chunk of people. But I have a feeling that if faith is that entrenched and for that long, because this has been going on since the 40s, you know, it would take a while to break, you know, that kind of an entrenched belief system. So I kind of feel like, you know, we should have seen a little bit of that conflict in there. And I kind of feel like they should have done more with it, and it just wasn't there. So, yeah, I think that this whole thing had a rocky start for me.
Yes, yes, yes. So much there to be explored. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Okay, I'm going to go a little different route on this one and say I don't think that it was exposed too soon, but I think that it was done poorly and unrealistically. And what Steve just said made me think of another scenario to add to the other one that I was going to bring up. The first one I'll hit was Steve. I think Steve brings up a good point, is that the media machine probably wouldn't have touched this story, or it would have sat on it or something like that. If they really wanted to do this well and make it a different kind of plot point, it would have been an Alex Jones type character exposing something like this.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, okay.
I would have bought that.
Yeah, that totally.
That would have been fascinating, and also brought up this idea of new media versus old media, and who believes what, and people attacking each other over fake news, and just tons of stuff like that. So that's one idea. The other thing is, if we do it the way that they did it, so it's exposed on CNN, it comes out, everybody's buying this, then the ramifications would be much more catastrophic than what we saw. You would see every politician trying to distance themselves from it, people trying to campaign on it, people disavowing, stock prices plummeting, stuff getting pulled off shelves, crisis of faith everywhere, people actually having, you know, suicides and riots. I mean, it would, because this whole society is based on this idea. And so when you crush that idea, you're going to have some people that are absolutely going to believe still. But a lot of people are going to be, you know, totally disillusioned. And so society is going to start breaking down, because when we watch this show, everywhere you go, supers are at the middle of it. All of our branding is about supers. Our movies are about supers. Our TVs, our entertainment, everything has to do with supers. Now suddenly we found out that the whole thing is a science experiment. You're going to have to come up with a really good lie to try and put that genie back in the bottle, or at least put the genie in a different bottle. Something like, well, we lied about, you know, throw the Christians under the bus and be like, we lied about the Christianity thing because we didn't think humanity was ready for this science yet. But now you are. In fact, we're the ones that leaked it because we wanted to see how society would react, you know, something like that. But meanwhile, all of society is starting to crumble, and you having to do something like that. You might even have the president of the United States going, Vought, you need to get this crap under control, because United States society is falling apart. You know, cats and dogs are living together, and we just can't have it, you know? So.
Yeah. It should have been much more widespread. It should have been felt all over the country, and it wouldn't have happened kind of with a wink or a whimper or a sigh or whatever.
Yeah.
Up in arms. Same way Starlight was when she found out the truth about what she was versus what she thought she was. She had a serious existential crisis, as anyone would.
Yeah. And there's so much you could have done with. I mean, bring Gloria Allred in for a guest appearance, and she's suing the deep. You know, Gloria Allred is representing 25 female superheroes who were molested.
Oh, there you go.
And, you know, Sony cancels a 7-picture movie deal with Vought Industries, and, you know, it's like everything's going to hell. So,
yeah.
Okay, now that is a great transition into my next question. My next question was, what are your thoughts about the deep as a metaphor for the Me Too thing, because they're really raking him over the coals? At first, I thought it's just Aquaman, but now I see it's also to make sure that he pays and pays and pays and pays and pays for stuff that Homelander's been doing worse and more, and it's so analogous to what life is like now. But the Deep has to pay because he's a loser man doing that stuff. And Homelander doesn't pay because everybody's afraid of him and he'll kill them, but he's done worse things. So again, like I said, it's not just the Aquaman aspect. They're trying, at least I think so, they're trying to say, look at this little man who thinks he's a man and thinks he's a hero and tries to use that position to get girls to be with him. But no matter what he does, he's just a schmo. He's just a loser. So if we keep it on the superhero level, I can kind of deal with it. But it's starting to feel to me anyway, just like it's getting a little bit heavy-handed about the repentance path or whatever, or the apology tour. Because the Deep is living it now. He's a living apology. And then here comes Stormfront on the complete other end of the spectrum. So we'll get to her in a minute. But I want to hear your thoughts about what they're doing with the Deep, because, you know, I really don't care that much about him as a character. But now that it's moving into this kind of thing, I'm like, he's becoming even more one note. And that note seems to be, you know, you got pay forever for what you've done. You're forever tainted. You'll never be part of the Seven. You'll never be a man. You'll never be accepted. There's no forgiveness. There's no nothing for you. So tell me what you think about that. Start with Steve.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I'm kind of thinking that he's also a metaphor for somebody who's been canceled. That's essentially what happened to him.
Yes.
He was basically canceled by Vought and by the Seven, and he's an outcast. And, you know, and now he's doing the walk of shame, and he's going to do the walk of shame for the rest of his life because he's never going to get what he wants, which is, you know, back in the good graces of the Seven. You know, he's not going to get, all those endorsements and live the life that he had before he was kicked out. So there's a little bit of that. I can see the Me Too aspects of it as well. Honestly, the whole thing is eye rolling. Everything about this character is eye rolling. I'm not going to go into another one of those rants like I did last time. I don't think it's quite that bad, and I don't think it deserves that. Honestly, it's just one of those things where I'm kind of tired of seeing this character. I don't think he adds anything significant. At the very least, the Gills didn't talk or sing this time, so at least we got spared that horror. But in general, I just don't. I don't like anything that they're doing with him. I don't like the superhero metaphor. I'm kind of tired of seeing Aquaman being treated like a joke all the time. I don't particularly like, you know, the whole Shane male aspect of this character. Clearly, the writers think that it's funny. I don't think that it's funny. I think the joke is played out. And I'm just generally want to see him go away, preferably underwater for the rest of the show.
Yep. I have to agree with all that. Just nothing's hitting. Nothing's interesting. It's all just like, ugh. Like that bad aftertaste you get when you get hold of some bad soda. Like, go away. Go ahead, Nemesis.
You know, it's interesting. I'm not going to defend the Deep or anything, and I see what you're saying, but I kind of looked at this a little bit after we had talked the last time, and I think that the Deep and Huey have a little bit in common in that they are both, at certain times in the series, have been the quintessential beta males with inadequacies, and they're dealing with things. But they deal with them in very different ways. And you see the beta male in Deep is just traded his subservience and his you know, from one group to another group. And, you know, he's treating women right, but he's only doing it so he can get something out of it. You know, he really hasn't found his masculinity, found his place within society, found a way to interact with women in a positive way. He's just doing it because it's a way to get where he wants to go and have some acceptance within this new organization he's a part of. Versus Huey, who had a loss. He was never a very, you know, strong masculine character, but has grown into his masculinity and continues to grow into it. So much so that he started to take a borderline alpha role within a group of alpha males, you know, in The Boys. So I think you have two divergent paths. I mean, I don't want to be too psychological with everybody, but I think that's what you're really seeing if you really sit there and analyze the two characters, is that you had two, you know, males that I think I'm comfortable in saying they weren't alpha males when this whole thing started, and they've taken divergent paths, and you've seen growth with Huey, and you've seen a transference, and he's really just a beta male by a different name in the deep.
That's a cool analysis.
Okay. Go ahead, Bracey. What do you think?
It's funny he mentioned that. It sparked off a new thought in my mind. Thinking back to like when the deep first proposition to Starlight, he's like, come on, it's not that big a deal. It's only going to take like 3 minutes anyway. And I believe that is a quote from one of the women who alleged that Harvey Weinstein sexually assaulted them. So they tied that in. It's like, come on, it's just take a few minutes out of your life, and then you get what you want, I get what I want, that sort of thing. It's the exact same sort of deal. You know, and I'm like the rest of you guys. I'm tired of this joke. The joke isn't funny. It was only funny for a moment and only briefly. And so, like, the only time we really see the deep really use his powers, you know, and they're like, this is the big topper on the cake. You know, we get to see the deep actually being effective at what he does. And then, of course, they're going to go and subvert that with, like, the killing of the sperm whale and everything. You know, he even strikes the Aquaman pose, you know, everything. And like
sperm whale, haha.
Sperm whale. Everything the deep does just goes to crap.
Yes.
So he can't even get his moment to shine because that's how punished he's got to be. And like Nemesis said, he is contrite not out of a sense of true repentance, but because it's a forced repentance, which isn't genuine. And none of us care about the deep. I don't care about the deep. I don't know who cares about the deep. Nobody seems to care about the deep. The problem for me is, looking at it with my writer's spectacles on, I see something interesting here that's being put aside and not used. We get these little tidbits with the deep. We find out about his body and his body image and why he would want to be a womanizer. Because he needs to prove himself to himself. You know, he needs to feel attractive. He needs to feel, you know, he's around people like Homelander, so he needs to feel powerful. He needs to feel masculine. And then in the group session today, you find out how it was for him growing up as a kid when he started, like, the first thing he hears are goldfish begging for their lives. He's like, oh, God, I got a red lobster, and all the lobsters in the tank are screaming at me to help them. It's like, that's horrible. That's horrifying. Can you imagine how that would warp a kid? No wonder he's like, you know, trying to save dolphins from the, you know, the SeaWorld analog and stuff like that. That would be such an interesting character, an interesting place to take the character. And we get these little tidbits like he wants to get into, like, you know, conservation and, you know, that sort of eco-activism. But he doesn't even get a chance to be good at that. He is constantly the loser. He is constantly the butt of the joke. And it's kind of sad to me because I think you could do something with the character, but they're just stuck in this idea that, like, you know what? Somebody needs to pay for me too. It's going to be the deep.
And building on your point, they make even that part of his character a joke when the sperm whale dies and he's sitting there hugging it and everybody's looking at him like he's pathetic.
Yeah, it's the same thing like when he tried to rescue the dolphin and when he was doing his little promo spot on the beach a few episodes back. Yeah, they don't even give him that. So the character doesn't get anything redeemable. And if you can't make the character relatable or likable to any extent, why is he on the screen? There's no reason for him other than he's just your, you know, your cardboard cutout punching bag for no other reason than just that.
I get the feeling the writers hate him, or at least, you know, enjoy dumping on him. And I don't think that that's good for a character.
No, it's not good for the show.
Well, they clearly hate Aquaman. And yeah. I have never hated Aquaman. I've never understood the hatred or calling him lame or whatever. I have never felt that way, but that's just me. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is Kimiko and Kenji. Now, hold off on talking about Stormfront. We're going to get to Stormfront right after this because I want to focus a section on her. But I want to talk about specifically Kimiko and Kenji and that whole thing because, first off, I knew that Kenji was not long for this world. And the reason I knew he wasn't long for this world was because he's so powerful. And because he's so powerful, he could tip the balance if he's actually on Butcher's side. He could really tip the balance of power in Butcher and the boys' favor if he was going to be a permanent fixture. So when I first saw him, I was like, this is going to be great. They're going to have a serious chance to fight back. They've got Kenji now, blah, 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 blah. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, no, that means he's not going to make it.
Yeah.
And so once again, but when I look at his relationship with his sister, for the short time he's around, they were trying to give us some depth, give us some connection, give us some more background, give us kind of the resolution on everything that Kimiko has been carrying since we met her. So my question to you guys is, did they do that well? When you looked at that brother-sister relationship and you looked at everything that's happened in the last three episodes leading up to the end of this one, do you think that they set it up, developed it, and paid it off well to make us care about their relationship, to see, get a little bit more insight into Kimiko's pain? You know, do you think that was done well or not? And then from there, we're going to jump to Stormfront. But let me hear about that. Start with Brett.
Start with who?
Start with you.
Okay, sorry. The last part of the word cut out for a bit. You know, there's a lot I did like about it. I did like the relationship between Kimiko and Kenji. Unfortunately, I think they needed... Yeah, they got a pretty good amount of time together in the previous couple episodes, or at least last episode. I wish they'd had more time to talk in this episode. It was a little too brief for me. I think we should have spent a little bit more time developing that. But I did like the relationship. The payoff was very expected. Like you, I expected this guy to die because he is just way too powerful. And he demonstrates that. And he puts the Homelander in his place for a moment at least. So, there's just no way you could have him on the team. But I just wish they could have done a little bit more with it. But I still liked it for the most part. And the payoff was appropriate that, briefly he had to come to the realization, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, when everything kind of goes sideways on him.
You there?
Yeah, that's all I got.
Oh, that's all. Okay.
Yeah, it's just brief. Just brief.
All right, cool. All right, go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I don't think that they expanded enough on certain points. That whole brother-sister dynamic, and they've been separated and they come together, is very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. And then to suddenly have to have Kimiko first take her brother out and then have him chained up, and this whole argument they're having about that terrorist organization, that needed to be much more heated. We needed some more detail about why one sibling feels so strongly about that group and the other sibling has now seemingly come over to their way of thinking, and the divide it's put between them and the sadness and shame and hurt and anger, because you have so many different layers of emotion there. And I think we're constrained by two things. One is the fact that one character can't actually speak, you know, no matter how much they try and do with the sign language and the subtitles, it doesn't carry the same emotional weight and can't convey the same amount of depth of feeling and words. And then the other thing is, I just think we needed more time. We needed to see some more of what was going on in their heads, some more of their relationship, and to understand how deeply each of them probably felt wounded by the other and that sense of betrayal, so that when the inevitable is going to happen to Kenji, then that sense of hurt, anger, and betrayal is going to turn to grief and guilt on Kimiko's part.
And rage. Don't forget the rage. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I think I'm generally with the rest of you guys. My general feeling was like, okay, I enjoyed what we got, but I felt like there could have been more. And it just really kind of got me, like, how I feel like there's still gaps there. Partially it is the language barrier that is a problem, but part of it is just there's a lot of stuff that the show is juggling around, and I just didn't feel that they had time for it. We did get some good information in the time we had. I kind of wish that Frenchie had learned the sign language.
Yeah.
Because that would have been really, really helpful. And it would have been, it would have allowed the relationship between him and Kimiko to progress a little bit more. But unfortunately, we didn't get that. One thing that I will kind of point out is that I really got an Akira vibe from Kenji the entire time. Like, he really reminded me a lot of Tetsuo, both because he's a telekinetic, he's Japanese, but also because he, the whole idea that he gets his power from these scientists, and he just wants to lash out at these people that did this to him and messed up his life. And you kind of get a little sense of that. So he does kind of feel like he had that archetype, with that, and especially in contrast to, Kimiko, who is the Kaneda in this sense. She's the one that's trying to restrain him, trying to stop him from lashing out in anger. So I kind of felt like there was definitely that little bit of that. The last thing I will say is that I think that Karen Fukuhara should be credited massively for selling what we got. Because I felt like the performance was excellent. Like, you can definitely tell that she's trying to overcome the fact that her character can't speak, with the visual performance and with the gestures and the body language and all of that. You can tell the love that's on her face for this man, even though she can't say that. She can't tell him that she loves him, that she loves her brother. But, you can tell that it's there. Just from the way that she acts with him and the time that they have together, you can see it on her face when she's just looking at the screen at the end of the episode in absolute rage, because she's looking at the woman who murdered her brother and she wants to kill her. It's just so well done. And so much of it is the actress's performance overcoming the limitations of the script. And I think she should be credited massively for that.
Well, also, it's a reminder, talking about that end shot, a reminder of the feral nature of Kimiko and how, sometimes we forget actually what she is and what she does. And now that's been stirred up in a way that is going to be unleashed, and there's going to be a lot to pay. Okay, before we end out on Stormfront, let's take a side jump. And let's talk about Starlight's moral choice. She's in a situation that we knew was going to happen at some point. I thought Homelander was just going to kill them both anyway. So I'm surprised he even gave her an out, because they're so obviously working together. And also, does Homelander have super hearing or not?
He does.
I asked that more than once the entire time. I mean, we did see that he heard what Becca was saying from a long distance away. And I'm like, why is he not hearing Huey's breathing, for example? Mm-hmm. So, that didn't work.
Maybe it's like his vision. Maybe he has to choose to turn it on and turn it off.
Like Ultra Boy.
Yeah.
Even though he can use more than one power at a time. Because this is a lot like Spider Sense. It's very selective. But how he doesn't know that Annie and Huey are working together is beyond me. But anyway, if they're asking us to buy that, I really thought he was just going to kill him anyway, because that's more Homelander. But, there's got to be some type of torment and taunting. And so he says, no, Annie, I want you to kill him. And she was going to. And so what did you think about that? What did you think about how she responded? And Huey looked like he was just going to close his eyes and go with it. And I was like, you are already whipped enough by this girl. Now you're just going to lay down and die, really? You're not going to fight? You're just going to let her take you out, really? You're not going to run? You're not going to swing? You're not going to do anything? You're just going to close your eyes and just end it? Okay. Really? So as you can tell, I was not too happy. But in terms of what it's done for Starlight, I have to agree with Stormfront's initial assessment of her, that she is now Vought Barbie. And she has crossed more lines than she thought she would. And she is not the girl we met last year. She has clearly decided that, like we talked about last pod, she's going to stay in the Seven so that she can dismantle Vought or whatever. But she's doing that writer thing that character that they have characters do, where you cross all these moral lines and you commit all these crimes for the quote-unquote greater good. But that affects you as a character. You still get consequences for doing that. And so, I don't know. I guess I'm trying to say my respect level for her feels like it slipped a little bit. And I didn't want it to, but I kind of feel like it had. I thought at the last minute maybe she could spin and turn on Homelander. Maybe she can do, I don't know. I thought both of them were going to do something different other than stand there and let it happen, which is what was going to happen if Butcher hadn't spoken up. So let me know how you felt about that whole scene. Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, I think I understand why you don't like this, because I know that you don't like, as a general rule, the deconstruction of heroes. Uh-huh. You know, and this whole series deconstructed the superhero and turned them into the villains, but it's all just also deconstructing the actual heroes of the show. I think the whole theme of this season so far has been that there are no heroes, and that even if you're going to do heroic things, you're going to have to get dirty. And we've seen that progression in Huey, and we've seen that progression in Starlight. And I think we've already seen that Mother's Milk, Frenchie, and Butcher are, you know, neck deep, or at least waist deep in the mud, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the whole point of this concept, is that nobody's really clean at all, you know? And so it depends on how you feel about that whole concept and what you think about, you know, morality and shades of gray, and that is a very long discussion. But I think that's what they're really trying to say, is that when you're doing this type of work, especially in the real world, which, you know, I think The Boys is trying to show us a quote-unquote real world in superhero terms, mm-hmm. that even when you're doing the right things, you have to do the wrong things for the right reasons sometimes. That's what the show is trying to say. So take that for what it is. That's what I think they're doing there.
That's interesting. Go ahead, Steve. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. There are no heroes in this show. None whatsoever. It's basically two groups of bad guys going at it. It's just, what degree of bad guy do you like? And I would say, yeah, Huey and Starlight are like the less bad people. But Starlight, I mean, you can kind of tell it's kind of going the way of Angel's fifth season, where Angel was working for Wolfram and Hart, and he was just continuing going into villainous territory the entire time, because that organization corrupts you. It's just the way it is. And I feel like Vought is the same way. And Starlight does not have the moral strength to resist this. She likes being at the center too much. She enjoys being part of the Seven too much. And she's honestly too afraid, to slip out of the mask or let the mask drop and be herself. And it's kind of unfortunate, but I think we're just going to see more and more of this. As for the moral choice itself, I was just kind of groaning a little bit, because I knew there was no way that they would actually have her kill Huey. They were going to get in the way of this in some way or another. And I feel like a little bit cheated because they took away her agency and her choices by having Butcher come out at the last minute, even though it had to be done. I mean, there's no way that they're, because the alternative is Huey dies. I mean, let's face it. But even so, it's like, this is why you don't put them in this situation, because, you know, something's going to get in the way of it, you know, because they have to maintain the status quo. And I just kind of groaned a little bit. There was a good setup, But the problem is there's no way that they're going to pay it off with any amount of, shall we say, brass. You know, they're not going to follow through. And that's kind of unfortunate because you really do want to see these characters making those tough decisions. But, you know, they're just never going to make a decision that's so tough that it's going to break the show. And I think it showed here.
Okay. Okay. Tough decisions, but won't go all the way with it. Okay. Go ahead, Bryson.
I'm going to be on the opposite side of this particular argument. I don't think there is any way in hell, even with her fear of the Homelander, her desire to do things from the inside, and her kind of like, you know, giving up part of her soul to, you know, work within Vought. She was not going to kill Huey. And I think part of the clue there is, you know, Huey might have just been closing his eyes in acceptance. But I kind of read it as like, we all know that her powers are light-based. And the one thing you want your allies to do is to close their eyes. I think given just an instant longer, she would have totally spun on like on Homelander and just given him the solar flare right in the face and would have tried to mate off with Huey. I don't think she's that far. I don't know if the character will ever get that far, even though she's done some pretty shady things. Asking somebody to kill their lover is a far cry from blackmailing your teammate. And given even with her fate shaken up and her lifestyle changed so greatly, I think at her core she's still who she is. She's got some shades of gray added in there, but she's still kind of that, you know, that small town girl basically. With those values, I just don't see her actually going through with that. I think she'd have turned on him, even if it meant that she died too.
Yeah, I buy that as well. Because something had to happen to stop it, but like you guys were saying, she should have stopped it. She should have done something.
But they're not going to show the consequences of that either. I mean, either way, they're not going to follow through, and it's like, why present the gun if you're not going to pull the trigger?
True.
But I'll push back a little bit on that and say, I don't think that Starlight had any choice. There's no way that she had to have known that, and Huey had to have known that. There's no way that she's going to beat Homelander. And so, you know, I'll come at it from a little different position, but, you know, being in the military, you are going to be forced to do things that are morally wrong. I'm just going to come right out and say it. And you're doing it for the right reason, but it's still not going to sit well with you, and it stays with you for the rest of your life. And that's all I'm going to say. You know.
Yeah, but you know what? There's the other side of that coin. You always have a choice. And sure. I think sure. even with the unwinnable situation there, that whole Kobayashi Maru, I think she'd have still chosen to stand against Homelander, even if it was just to try and flee with Huey.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's what we've been arguing since there have been people, is do you follow orders unconditionally or not? Do you sacrifice others to save your own skin, or do you sacrifice yourself?
Well, I mean, we used to do this. I don't want to get too deep into it, but we used to do this in philosophy classes at West Point all the time. And one of the ones is, you know, discuss the philosophical ramifications. This was an actual test question we had to write about of, you know, your platoon is going down the street and a terrorist has rigged a child with a bomb vest, you know, and the child is running away from, you know, be something scared, and there's like a tripwire attached to it. The only way to stop them is basically to shoot the child so they don't keep going and blow up your whole platoon. Do you shoot the child, or do you allow your platoon to get blown up?
Yeah. Yeah, those tough choices are real out in the field.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't necessarily mind the setup. I just didn't really like the payoff. And again, it's the same thing you have to do with Superman. You know, those super senses of his make a whole lot of things kind of ridiculous. He's using his powers all the time. And so everything that Huey and Starlight have been doing is, you know, it being under the radar still feels really ridiculous to me. And the other thing about them that gets on my nerves is that they're doing that makeup breakup dance You know that sick dance you can do with someone where you break up with them, but you don't really break up with them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You break up with somebody, but your emotions don't? They're doing that thing, and it's just getting on my nerves. I'm like, either be in love and be a couple or forget it. But this thing you're doing is just irritating. So finally, let's get to Stormfront, because she deserves her own little section. We finally get more information all the way around the bend. We can see more of what her powers are and what she can do. We see more of who she is as a person, which is racist to her core. We see that she's just as much of a sociopath as Homelander. And we also see that she's purposely, she's doing the one thing that almost nobody else on this show will do, which is throwing all that at Homelander's face. You snooze, you lose, Gramps. Oh, my goodness. And so my take on that is, first off, because I've watched, you know, I'm current with the episode, so I kind of know where this goes. But if I had to pretend like I'd only seen the first three, my first take on it was they have done something here that I didn't think was possible, which was make the Superman character actually vulnerable, give him a one character or two that wasn't afraid of him, which I don't think was possible. And they didn't sacrifice or compromise his power level like they always do with Superman. They always nerf Superman with whatever he's dealing with. The answer is always to nerf him. But here, they haven't nerfed Homelander, but instead they've given him someone who, and you know, more stuff to come down the road, not going to spoil anything in this pod, but someone who's not afraid of him, someone who's throwing all of his insecurities in his face, someone who's buying for the chief seat for all of the attention. And by the end of the episode, she is indeed the new face of the Seven, which is pretty much kind of like his worst nightmare. And so I thought all of that writing, acting, and directing was brilliant. When I watched the episode again, and you can see the seething hatred, because it's not just for Kenji. It's for the black family that she murders on her way to trying to stop Kimiko and Kenji. And she murders at least one. I don't know if she shuts up all of them, but that one girl was screaming and she takes her out.
Oh, shit. She murdered the whole tenement building by the looks of things.
Right. Because entire floors are blowing up and she's going up to find Kimiko and Kenji. And so you just see that real dark, sadistic tormenting, because she didn't just kill him. She broke him. She tormented him. And she said, open your eyes because I like to see the light go out. So she is a grade A psychopath.
Yeah.
She's not just kind of crazy. She cray cray exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what I think makes her interesting. And another thing I'll mention before I throw it out to you guys is that I know you've noticed there's been a lot of backlash on social media. You know, all four of us are on Twitter every day. But there's not been a lot of social media because some people are saying that they are trashing a Jewish character or a Jewish actress, or they are making her too dark, or there's just been some pushback against, her racism or whatever. And I'm like, don't you guys get that that's who this character is? Don't you think she's supposed to be like this?
Yeah.
She's supposed to be snarky. She's supposed to be sadistic. She's supposed to be brutal.
That's the point.
I can separate the character from the actress, so, you know.
Then there's that whole thing about maybe growing up and not confusing your entertainment with real life.
Yeah.
And which we're losing that line. We lost that line a long time ago. I'm so sorry we have. But, you know, so I'm just like, I'm amazed. I'm like, because I knew this was going to happen last year. I said, what's going to happen now is that you're not going to be able to write any villains. If you don't write a villain that's an alien, and even if you do, if they think the alien is an analog for some group, they're going to screen racism or persecution or misogyny or something.
Although you could write the Deep as a villain.
Well, yeah. You know, if it's a white guy, oh, yeah,
he's
sure.
He's okay.
Right, yeah. As long as we're trashing white guys, sure, that's the order of the day. But I'm on Stormfront, I would not change one iota of this character. I love the actress. I love the character. I love what she's about because it's such a perfect foil for Homelander, and it's such another perfect embodiment of what we talked about earlier about how there are no heroes. What would power do to real people? Well, that would be Homelander and Stormfront. If real people got that kind of power, that's exactly what would happen. So, once again, using my writer code vision, I'm like, this character couldn't be any more brilliant. Perfectly cast, perfectly acted. I don't even know that. So anyway, let me hear your thoughts about Stormfront and getting more revelations on her and how she kills Kenji and, you know, just your general impression of her and power set, the whole nine. Start with Steve.
Okay, I really get the impression that everything that we have seen up to this point with Stormfront, or at least it looks to be partially an act now, because we have seen the mask drop. She's not, you know, somebody who's trying to call out Vought because, you know, she really cares about Vought in any way. All of this is about advancing herself, positioning herself to be popular so that she can basically knock off Homelander as the top dog. And I think also the secondary thing, and this may actually be make her worse, she clearly enjoys the carnage that she causes. She likes cutting loose. She likes murdering people. And, you know, the whole line about, I enjoy watching the light go out of your eyes. This is who she really is. And she is a total monster. She's horrible. And clearly that was by design, but at the same time, it's hard to take your eyes off her. She's an entertaining character for sure. Because, we have fun watching her calling out characters that need to be called out. She drops the truth bombs when she needs to. You know, she really doesn't care what other people think because she is such a sociopath. And so she's fascinating as well. And I really do think it's clear. I had heard that she was supposed to be an alt-right or Nazi character. That definitely showed here. I mean, she's a complete racist. She clearly does not care about any of these people. And she seems to even, enjoy, killing people that don't look like her because they don't look like her. Throwing that one dude out of the window because, he was black. Killing Kenji and then, following it up with the racial slur about calling him a yellow bastard. She's horrific. She's absolutely horrific, but yet she's fascinating. And this is what The Boys does well. I mean, they have these characters that are just completely deplorable and terrible, but you can't keep your eyes off of them because they're so well written. They're layered. They have they surprise you at the right moments. And I think Stormfront has been a very good example of this. Homelander, too, to a certain extent. But Stormfront is definitely, very good at capturing attention. And I have to say, the time when she called out the Deep, oh, yeah, you're in that cult. You're an idiot. I'm like, yes, he is an idiot. He absolutely is. She's right about this. But then, they come in later with her, murdering all these people in the tenement building. And I would not be surprised if she killed every single person in that building. I really wouldn't be. So you have on the one hand, this side that you really like about her. But you have to reconcile it with the fact that, she's a racist mass murdering, what. But that's great character writing. I can't fault her at all. I mean, she's been one of the best things about season two.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Bracey.
Okay. I'm with Steve. I'll go a step further, because I was telling my wife as I was watching the episode, she was asking about the show. I was like, oh yeah, this character here, I know for a fact she is killing everyone she comes across in the building because she has the perfect foil. Like, oh, the terrorist did it. I tried to save them. But, that guy Kenji was killing them all with his powers. It doesn't, the Vought will cover up that there are electrical burns all over them. She gets to cut loose. She gets to play. She and the Homelander are not opposite sides of a coin. They're the same side of the coin, just a different flavor. Because he's the same way in a lot of ways. He can't wait to cut loose. And so this was the perfect opportunity for her. Now, I know from like a little clip I caught of an interview. And it was, it's very telling. Even if I hadn't seen it, I'd understand this. And also knowing from like who she represents in the comic books, one of the few characters who could actually challenge the Homelander. And the whole reason she can be so flippant with Homelander is because she doesn't fear him. She's the only person outside of perhaps Black Noir, because we don't know what his mindset is, but he always appears at ease around Homelander. But she clearly doesn't fear him because she's likely as powerful or perhaps in her own way more powerful than Homelander. And I'm sure they're going to get into that as the series goes on. So she's got that going for her. And, you know, when you have that kind of confidence, you know, when you're that certain in your power, you know, like, oh, yeah, I don't have to give a crap about you. You're yesterday's news, Grandpa. And it also bespeaks to something we were talking about last time, how, like, we were trying to figure out, why is she in here? Why is she in the Seven when she clearly doesn't fit the kind of mold that they've presented with all the other characters? I mean, you look at her. She's always breaking the immersion. She is far shorter than both Starlight and Maven. Everybody else is wearing bright colors for the most part, unless it's part of your setup like Black Noir. She's dressed in the dark colors. I think that's a fun contrast, the fact that, you know, here's Homelander, he's big, he's tall, he's beautiful, he's muscular, he's got the bright primary colors, and here this teeny tiny woman that's gonna be the challenge to him, wearing her all black little outfit. And she's even got, like, you know, a little short cape. She doesn't even have like the floor length cape, but she's packed with all this power. And she's so clearly a Nazi that she's even got her, you know, a friend of mine pointed this out to me. We're talking about like the shaved head, and he's like, yeah, it's only shaved on the right side. It's like, oh, good eye, man. Good eye. Just an extra little, like a part of the code indicator kind of there. But I like that contrast between her and Homelander, and it does make both of them these fascinating sociopathic, psychopathic characters. So I'm curious to see where they're going to go with that, because Homelander's not used to dealing with this sort of thing. But I still wonder, because of her position and her power, how that affects the head of the company, because Giancarlo's character, you know, he already can't really control Homelander, although he seems to think he can in some ways. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, how is she working for a black dude? I know she's getting all these benefits from him, so maybe she just feels like she's using him. So there's still something weird going on there, and I want to know what's going to come of this. So I'm really hyped to see where this is going to go.
Absolutely. See, Homelander needs everybody to love him and needs everybody to need him.
Mm-hmm.
But Stormfront needs everybody to be uncomfortable. There's no word that comes out of her mouth that doesn't create an awkward situation. And that's because she is full of seething rage at the world around her. Because it's people that are full of rage that do stuff like that, that make it their point to make sure everybody else is uncomfortable when they show up. And she does that every time she's anywhere. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I'm gonna hit this from a little different point, and I'm gonna talk directly about the writers. I think that this writing of her over these three episodes is brilliant. I think she is the ultimate gaslighting character, at least for 2020. Because the first two episodes, I thought, you know, I haven't read the comics, so I was watching this. I had not picked up on that she's a Nazi at this point, although I have watched ahead, but I'm just telling you how it was when I was watching this episode. I did pick up that she was racist. But the first two episodes, I thought she was merely the snarky character who spoke truth to power and had some power set. Wasn't quite sure exactly what she was. Then, you know, suddenly I see her doing, you know, some various things. And then suddenly it just all goes off the rails. And I'm like, she's taking out apartment complexes and she's showing that she's a racist. So right there, they've suddenly just completely thrown something at me and thrown me for a loop. You know, then she reveals her racism even further with what she does to Kenji and what she says to him. So that's, you know, hit me for a double punch. And then to top it all off, when Homelander comes out and she's upset with him, any other character would quake in fear and this girl's got, excuse my language, this girl's got some balls on her. and just gives it back to him, which leaves me thinking, when I'm watching this episode for the first time, going, all right, what, how exactly, how powerful is she? You know, because you're not speaking like that to Homelander unless you feel comfortable. You know, so right away, I'm like, okay, what is going on with this chick? And I want to know. You know, and then on top of that, they've written a character who's clearly a psychopath. She's clearly a sadist. She likes to inflict pain. And we're going to come to find out later, she's also a masochist. She likes pain as well. So she's got the triumvirate there. She's a psychopath, a sadist, and a masochist. You know, it's like, okay, well, this is a broken character. And yeah, it's great. You know, it's great that we're going to love to hate her as we watch her on screen. So kudos to the writers of the original comic book series and kudos to the writers on the TV show, because I had not read the comics and I had no clue this was coming through the first two episodes, and I didn't even know where it was going to go until it actually happened at the end. So
I'll tell you, if you don't mind me interjecting a moment, the Stormfront in the comic books is nowhere near as interesting as this iteration of the character is.
Yep.
She's way more interesting.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, the original one was kind of like a throwaway character in many ways. This character is much
basically
deeper.
He's basically just super Nazi.
Yeah.
And they've made something a lot more interesting and, like Steve said earlier, much more compelling to watch.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, a lot of times we speak of gaslighting in a bad way. I am so pleased that the writers gaslit me on Stormfront and it suddenly sprung it on me, because it was a, I'm not going to say a pleasant surprise because she's not pleasant, but it was a surprise and I enjoyed watching it. So,
and see, this is fun. This is where I want to marry Sue.
Yeah.
They're trying to make us uncomfortable, and I think that they succeeded with that.
Absolutely. And again, just using our writer's code vision, it's brilliant writing. She's compelling. She's intriguing. She's highly motivated. She's powerful, but not just her powers. It's her ability to get underneath your skin and kind of step on whatever nerve you might have exposed and nerves you don't have exposed. She can kind of get a feel for what would make this person the most uncomfortable. Let me say that. She's that person. And so, you know, we can't wait to see where this is going with her and what she's really about. And I also must admit, it's about this time in the season that I'm wishing there were more than 8 episodes.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're going to, you know, have a great payoff to the season and a great setup for the next season. But I'm really wishing there were maybe like 10 or max 12, but I could definitely take more than 8.
I tell you, that's the tough thing, though, because, like, I've seen seasons of shows, you know, when you got the 22 seasons, like, oh, it's just dragging on. This is filler. And then other times you're like, oh, you know, it's nice and tight, you know, the 8 or the 10 episodes. But the finding that balancing point, just enough time, not too little, not too much, to tell the story properly.
Right, right. Telling it properly. That's the whole key. All right. We're going to call it right there. Once again, this episode was really pivotal. Great payoff from a lot of threads, including threads from last season. Great setup for what we want to see happen next. So again, I just have to tip my hat to the writers here and the actors and directors, the whole thing. It's seamless. There's really nobody that takes me out of it. Really nothing that just makes me feel like it's a TV show. I feel like I'm watching footage all the time. I feel like this is happening in New York right now as we speak. And that just is a testament to the great writing and the visceral and real world grounding of this kind of show. So thank you so much for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to check out the other podcasts we have on United Capes Podcast Network. We have a lot of other different things going. I want to thank my co-host. Thank you so much, Dave.
No problem. Love talking to you guys.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah, same here. I feel like we had a pretty good time doing this, and I'm all for doing it again.
Thank you so much, Bracey.
Hey, man, it's always a pleasure to get together and nerd out with some friends.
And thank you, audience, for checking us out. And we will check you out and talk to you next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.